This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Gara Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gara Alperovitz, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here, Matt.
You said you were able to write this book in record time. What explains that?
Well, actually, I've been working on a big book for a long, a researchy book with lots of footnotes and lots of research. Long book. But last summer, somehow it just struck me that it was time. Something's happening in the country. There's a lot of action, a lot of movement, a lot of movement. And it seemed to me time to get something out that was drawing on all this work, but directed and spoken in a kind of ordinary language. You don't have to put in gobbledygook and scholarly footnotes and everything if you've got the facts. So it just poured out of me. My wife teases me. She says, how long is this book going to take? 5 years? 10 years? But this took about 3.5 months to just, it just poured out. I've never had that experience before, but it's very, conversational. People seem to find it's readable. It's kind of like, it's like a conversation, but it's drawing on all this research.
Yeah, I'm all about readability and comprehension. And I just think it's important for those of us who are trying to make this country a better place, a more democratic, more just place, that we forego the rhetorical masks that we put on and that get us in the way of communicating what we're saying, and drop the big words that we're trying to impress people with that just turn people off or make them think that you're just a snob. So we don't need that, really. Yeah. The book subtitle, Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. What is that next American Revolution?
Well, what I do in the book is there's two or three different things, but I take a look at why are we actually in the stalemate and the decay and the stagnation. And so is that likely to continue? Or is it kind of, it's going to be a cycle and it'll all be fine again and everything's going to change? So the first argument is no. In my judgment, there's a lot of good reasons why, not the kind of traditional collapse crisis, but an ongoing pain and decay and unemployment and underemployment and climate change problems, stalemate in Washington, that the big trends are going to continue. So that's number one. And I think that's forcing people to be aware that things are really different now, and that either we begin to move in another different direction or it just gets worse. And that's a big deal historically.
I mean, why can't it just continue? Why can't corporations just continue to run the show and the rich keep grabbing more and more of the income and people's real incomes stagnate or continue to drop? Unemployment still hover, around 7 or 8%. And I know the global climate change can't go on forever, but this corporate control certainly has a way of asserting and reasserting itself.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And at the end of the book, I sort of say, what are the options? Right. And logically, that is one of the options, that it would just gets worse and worse and decay and Rome decayed, and the corporate power stayed on top of the decaying mountain. That's a logical option, and we don't know. On the other hand, the pain and the frustration is also getting people to move in a way that the ordinary press doesn't want to cover, but also, the press has gotten, it doesn't have any reporters doing local things anymore.
Press barely exists anymore.
They're in financial difficulty. They can't cover stuff. So if you look hard at what's going on beneath the surface, there's a lot going on in this country that isn't getting reported, and that's a lot of what the book's about. So, for instance, the numbers are really interesting. We can draw on history. There's 130 million people involved in co-ops and credit unions. That's 40% of the society. Now, some of those are old. Some of them are new. There's a lot of new worker-owned co-ops starting up. Nobody reports this stuff except the progressive and places on the left that are beginning to get at it. But it takes a lot of reporting. And so just looking around at the co-op world and the worker co-op world, you see, driven by the pain, I think, driven by either you develop something new or it just gets worse. And I think that's the wake-up call that a lot of people are having. So a lot of the book is about, very, very decentralized ways in which people change ownership. And we can go into that, but systems, political economic systems, are all about who gets to own the wealth. You know, this feudalism was about who owned the land. And, you know, state socialism was the state owned the land, so, you know, the communist systems. I think an American system is going to be very decentralized and participatory and build up from the bottom and then build up over time. And maybe, if successful, driven by this pain. So co-ops and worker-owned and municipal ownership is another piece.
Talk a little bit more about worker ownership and how that's taking off. You have the example of Cleveland, which looked like a steel company the workers tried to take over, didn't quite succeed, but out of that success did come.
Yeah, that's I think, a really interesting lesson, because Ohio is really, you know, where the nation is now, but Ohio's been there for 30 years. I was involved in, way back in the 1970s, in Youngstown, Ohio, the first really big steel closing, that 5,000 people lost their job in one day. And back in 1977, that was a big deal, front page news everywhere. Now 5,000 people lose their job every day. So the workers and then an ecumenical group in Youngstown said, why don't we take over this mill and run it? And so they, you know, it seemed crazy. But in fact, they did their political organizing, they did their public education, they made it into a big national issue, and they got the Carter administration to finance a really sophisticated technical study for a couple $100,000, which today would be a couple of million in terms of inflation. And then they came up with a very good plan. And then they got the Carter administration, again, doing their political work, to commit to $200 million in loan guarantees. Now, they also knew that you better keep your political work going and your education, because the money disappeared after the election of 1978. On the other hand, they made such a big vision of what could be that you'll find worker-owned companies all over the state of Ohio now. Out of that experience, at Kent State University, there's a center that helps build worker-owned companies. That's developed, and, you know, over the last 30 years, there's a whole experience and knowledge base in that state. So recently, and over the last 6 years now, in Cleveland, out of that experience, there is an extraordinary expansion and innovation on the ground operating there with a complex of worker-owned companies, co-ops, in part driven by the Mondragon model, which links them together, and linked together with a nonprofit corporation, so that when they make some profits, it doesn't just make some workers rich or hardly rich, but some of it goes to the community. And then there's a revolving fund, so there's money is kicked in from profits so that more and more co-ops can be built and expanded. And more interesting still is, and this can happen in any city, and in fact, many cities are doing this now, so it's, you know, it's really important. You've got universities and hospitals right in the middle of a very poor neighborhood, you know, 40% unemployment, mostly black, you know, average family income, $18,000. Here they are, Case Western Reserve, Cleveland Clinic. You've got university hospitals there.
Yeah, some of the most prestigious hospitals in the country, actually, those two.
Yeah, really big deal. They're and very important, and they get a lot of press, too. They've gotten committed to buying from these worker co-ops. Now, that took a long time to get that commitment, but those three alone, and this is true in almost any city where you find hospitals and universities, these three alone buy $3 billion, that's with a B, in goods and services. And that's leaving aside their salaries and leaving aside their construction budget. That's just what they buy. A lot of that comes from public money, you know, state education money, federal education money, Medicare, Medicaid goes into those places. Why can't that be turned to purchasing from worker co-ops that build a community? And that's just what's happening in Cleveland. And they're not just little co-ops. I mean, they just opened up last month. This is the largest urban greenhouse in the United States, 3.1 acres, 3 million heads of lettuce a year. It's a really big deal. Then there's a very advanced industrial scale laundry, probably the greenest one in that part of the country. There's a solar installation company, and they're trying to put up one or two new companies a year to build a complex and literally rebuild that neighborhood and that community. So that's where you see the progression, which is what interests me. Over time, building on the failure in Youngstown, which got a lot of people going, building up over time, and here you see an expansion of worker-owned companies in the state, and then innovation to get more sophisticated over time in the Cleveland model.
I'm sitting with Gar Alperovitz. He's the author of Fascinating new book, What Then Must We Do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive. So you have this rise of co-ops, the rise of worker ownership. You mentioned municipal ownership. By that, you mean public utilities?
Yeah, public utilities. Most people don't realize, and again, it's just not covered by the press, 25% of American electricity is produced by socialism. Now, what does that mean? That means city ownership of utilities and co-ops. So there they are, and they can. I think there's 16 new ones in the last 10 years or so, and some are trying to take over existing utilities. We'll see how that goes politically, because that's the edge of this.
Excuse me. Yeah.
When we've got examples building up, and there are a lot of examples in all these areas, at some point, if the pain continues, and it's likely to continue, it has to take a political edge. People begin demanding this as well as just building models around the country. You got to do the model work. But, you know, if you look back at how the New Deal was developed, in the decades before the New Deal, and particularly in states like Wisconsin, so-called laboratories of democracy, they were developing state and local programs, and when the time was right, the very same principles were advanced for national political action. And that's what I think could be the basis.
Though you argue that the New Deal circumstances were unique and we're not going to have those again.
That's true, but the principle is the same. That is to say, I'll give you a non-crisis example of building up state by state by state and city by city by city, of learning how to do this stuff, building knowledge, changing ideology so that building common ownership is common in America, in co-ops and worker-owned companies and public utilities and land trusts. Not very fancy, but very, very important, because they change the idea of who gets to own. You know, 400 people currently own more wealth in this country than the bottom 180 million people.
Say that once more, will you?
I mean, it's a staggering number, isn't it? You have to get your head around this. 400 people, you can almost get them in this room we're sitting in, have more wealth than the bottom 180 million people. I threw that out in a lecture at one point, in the question and answer period, I said that's medieval. And some medieval scholar said, no, it was never that concentrated in medieval times.
That's grim.
It is grim. It really is grim. But, and also this is a very different image. The alternative to corporate capitalism was state socialism. But this is really very American, changing who gets to own, but building from the bottom up, only reaching higher levels if you have to, what the Catholic Church called subsidiarity. Everything stays local unless you have to go to the state level. Everything stays at the state level unless you have to go to the region, and only ending up with national change when necessary. So that's the model. It's a very American model.
And part of it is you talk about the ideological work that needs to be done, just the standing up for what we believe in and saying, look, yeah, we're all in these co-ops, or half of us are in co-ops. We've got the municipal utility, and we've got some worker ownership stuff going on that works. You know, this really isn't capitalism. This isn't the free market. This is an alternative to the free market.
Exactly.
And we need to talk about and celebrate these alternatives to the free market. Otherwise, we're just going to, people are just fed this myth about the free market constantly and think that that's all there is, or if there's an alternative, it's state socialism. So I like that aspect of this book and this argument. And there's a lot of socialism, good democratic American style socialism out there that you even talk about, like the public libraries. This is Barbara Ehrenreich talks about this all the time.
Right.
The public libraries are socialism. The Everglades, Yellowstone, Yosemite, that's socialism.
Right.
And the public schools, of course, they're under assault right now, maybe because it's a different model than the corporate model. In fact, that is why there is that fight. But so I agree with you both in the importance of doing this, standing up for what we believe in and talking about alternatives to the market. And I do recognize, as you point out so well in this book, that there is this rising movement of worker ownership, municipal ownership, co-op participation. A lot of the co-op participation increased when the banks collapsed over the last 4 years, because people understood that the corporate model was so bankrupt, literally bankrupt and corrupt. But at the national level, I'm staying with the banks. You talk about we need to nationalize the banks. I totally agree, and I advocated that in the bank crisis. It was ridiculous. We were overpaying for Bank of America and Citicorp anyway. When we were bailing out, we might as well bought the goddamn things. But we didn't do that. And there's a real question as to whether there was a sufficient power to do that. And so how do you get to that point? I mean, and how are the people who own the banks in the top 1% going to yield on those things?
Well, I mean, firstly, we did take over, you know, General Motors. We nationalized General Motors, and we sort of nationalized Chrysler, and we still own, nationalized, the biggest insurance company in the world, AIG. So we do know that in moments of crisis, interesting things happen. General Motors is not a small mom-and-pop store. So, you know, at this point, the politics does not permit a real solution because, so they, you know, after we subsidize it, we give it back. But the future may or may not change. That's why it's so important, I think, that we begin, you know, not only stand up and say what we want and say it in clear terms and have a lot of experience, but we really build from the bottom up so that we know what it is and people have the idea, and this is critical, ideas often don't matter in politics. That is, let's say power matters. But sometimes really important, it's very important to be clear about the ideas and a vision that is not communism, is not Soviet Union, but is based on real American hard work of what it looks like, building that up over time, everywhere around the country. I'm a historian. Think about the era before the Progressive Era, the 30 years at the end of the 19th century, or think about the decade-by-decade work when the women's movement first got the vote, state by state by state by state. That's the kind of work that's got to be done. You get that happening in a lot of cities and a lot of states around the country where people know that and experience it and it's not an abstraction. Then you're in a situation where saying, quote, nationalization or making it into what I like to call public utility makes sense because people understand the principle and because they've done it and they're, you know, take banking. There's 20 states that have considered now, got legislation to reproduce what the Bank of North Dakota, which is a socialist bank. It's sitting there right for 90 years running it, and there's an example. And lots of states are looking at that now. So the vision is not like we're going to jump in and take over. It is building up and learning and then speaking about a very, very different vision. You end up perhaps last at the national level as they continue to screw up.
And they will continue to screw up. There's no doubt about that. The question is just when push comes to shove, that there's going to be a battle. And what is that battle going to look like? Do you have any idea about that?
Well, at the end of the book, there's a chapter on options. The first thing is no matter what, it's roll up your sleeves and let's get going with what we can do. I mean, I'm kind of strongly kind of, I'm against folks who say, well, you know, it's inevitable that they're going to take over and we're going to lose no matter. Everybody's got a vested interest in pessimism. If you're pessimistic, you don't have to do anything because it doesn't matter. So we'll see. I'm a historian. Quote, revolutions are as common as grass around world history. The Berlin Wall collapses, apartheid collapses, a bunch of small farmers and merchants take on the biggest empire, the British Empire, and totally outgunned in the American colonies. They win. We'll see about the ultimate long-term battles. What's important now is to have a different experience, build up real solid stuff, and keep moving forward so that there's something that we know and a different vision and a different direction, different set of ideas about where we're going. Because, you know, it didn't make sense, the old models. The state socialist model didn't make sense. The conservatives were right. If you concentrate all that power at the top, you're going to lose democracy. Now, the anarchists were right about that too, but that's important sometimes to acknowledge that. So a very different structure. As I said, I don't think ideas matter often in history, but momentum matters and power matters.
But ideas are often camouflaged for power too. But.
Yeah, or phony. They're just camouflage.
Yeah.
But sometimes it really is critical to begin getting a very clear idea that that's the direction we want and we're not interested in the old stuff. We really have an idea. So I think that's, and it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, I think that when you look closely at what's happening at the ground, they begin to suggest a different vision as well. And you begin, that needs to be developed and articulated. I just wrote a piece for Truth Out. We need a whole debate on really what that looks like. But it doesn't look like the centralized models. Mm-hmm. But it has to be very, you know, it has to be smart.
And who are the actors that are going to carry out the vision? You talk about the decline of the labor movement. You know, there was one statistic in here that I didn't realize. I know labor's percentage of organization has dropped to about 11%, but you pointed out that that was the same percentage it was in the 1920s, and that's a bad rollback. And you quote John Kenneth Galbraith, who had the countervailing theory of power that you have capitalism on the one hand, you have labor unions on the other, and, you know, Ralph Nader used to talk about consumer power as another countervailing power. At this point, just on the labor union front, I mean, that power is really depleted, and it's unlikely to rise again in the short term.
I think that's right. In fact, that's one of the reasons we're in such great trouble. I mean, the whole progressive era of liberal politics and social democratic politics in Europe, the muscle was always labor organization as an institution. So in part, we're talking about building up worker co-ops and public banks, and we haven't talked about state-by-state public health systems like Vermont. And if you begin, or land trusts or municipal ownership, all of that is institutional. And I think ultimately that's the institutional base, the muscle behind the next progressive movement. I'm a movement guy, but if you build movements without institutions, you're weak. So it's not just let's organize a strong movement. We got to do that.
Yeah, but just because you belong to a co-op or just because your city has a public utility doesn't give you the idea that you're in a movement, you know, to the extent that people who are in labor unions recognize they're in at least a labor union or in a labor movement.
That's a very good question. And it doesn't unless you make it so. So that if and this is what's happening, if these institutions come out of demands by activists and come out by movement building, you get something totally different than, oh, there's just sitting there, the public utility, who cares? And that's, in fact, at the early part of the 20th century, there was a different line of development. It's called municipal socialism. So a lot of that, what we call public utilities, came out of a very decentralized activist base, and they were part of a movement.
And this was in Milwaukee. Sewer socialism, we called it, too.
Sewer socialism. But all over the country, you find, you know, all over the Northeast, even in the South, there's a lot of this. In the Southwest, where there's a populist version of it.
I drove through Alabama and saw little towns that were bragging about their municipal ownership.
Yeah.
It's very odd to me. I mean, it registered in my head, and then when I saw it here, I need a couple registrations before things really blink, but there it was when I saw it in your book again, too. I said, yeah, that was kind of strange and interesting.
Well, it is interesting, and what's also interesting about it is, quote, so-called conservatives. I'm not talking about national ideologues. I'm talking about people in Racine, where I'm from. If it makes sense and is practical, you just talked about the South, socialist institutions, public utilities, city-owned. If it's practical, it makes sense, if it's been thought through, you'd be surprised how the conversation you can have with so-called conservatives about worker ownership. With this Cleveland model, a lot of small businessmen say, hey, that's a really good idea. These guys want to work hard. They want to own something. You got to break through the national kind of debate about this and start looking for interesting allies at the grassroots level who want to see something work.
And some of those allies may be young people. You quote a study, a poll that came out, which also made me open my eyes a little wider, that said young people, I think it was 35 and under, or 30 and under, were equal as to, you know, whether they like capitalism or socialism.
Actually, there have been three studies now, and they've been moving slowly. People under 30, more favorable to the word socialism than to the word capitalism, just slightly. Now, that's really interesting in America. I mean, you know, I was brought up in the Red Scare and the communists and Joe McCarthy and all that. If the people who are going to build the next revolution are going to be younger people than I am, certainly, and that whole group of people is not lost in the old kind of logic of all that. I mean, if Obama's a socialist, right, unquote, quote. But people accept it. The other statistic I came across, Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which is the largest online dictionary, the words most looked up last year doubled. Capitalism and socialism. Now, all it tells you is that people are interested in, you know, something's changing. The wind is changing, so people are opened up. And again, you asked me why I wrote this book. There's a sense that it's time to have a much deeper discussion and also to look at very practical stuff and that's happening on the ground that gives people a sense of what can we do to begin building and maybe a theory of change. That is, the context is that we're entering a period where more and more pain is going to force people to start thinking. And here's some things that people are already doing that point towards a different vision.
My guest is Gar Alperovitz, who's got this visionary book out called What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. You just mentioned or President Obama, who's been called a socialist. I don't know any socialist, good socialist, who would advocate cutting Social Security. Why do you do such a thing?
Well, you know, don't get me started on Obama. he's a compromiser, and he's a very cautious guy, and he's not leading the fight. I think there was a base, and I think there is a base that he could have mobilized. I'm cool on things like this. Sometimes presidents just can't move, and then what can you say? I mean, you can attack him and criticize him, but there's no space politically to do something. I think he had space, and I think he has space, and I think he's chosen. You know, his whole career has been based on making compromises with the conservatives. That's how he became head of the Harvard Law Review. He brought in the conservatives, and he was a kind of a mediating guy. And, you know, he's done pretty well by being the conservative mediating guy, president of the United States. So that, I think that's who he is. That's his style. And we should push him, but we're not going to get a lot more.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right about that. Now, in the end of the book, you mentioned, and I read, that there are all these options that are facing this country. The worst option, of course, is fascism. How do you assess the risk of fascism in the U.S.?
You know, it's a crazy possibilities, but we just had violence in Boston. We don't know where that came from. It could have been a white violence like in Oklahoma City. We'll find out at some point what that's all about. But a little bit more of that, and, you know, there's going to be crackdown no matter what, left or right. And whether it takes the form of violence and real fascism and torture and all that, we'll see. It could be, you know, what, an American version of that or not.
Kind of an American Pinochet, maybe.
Could be a Pinochet, or there was the late Bertram Gross, who was a sociologist, called it maybe friendly fascism, which is not quite as nasty, but if you look a little deeper down. So that could happen. Let's hope it doesn't. It's not inevitable. It is a possibility, particularly if there's violence. But I'm also, in that same chapter, looking at coldly in the face, Pinochet's gone. And if you look south to Latin America, they had fascism in many, many countries. And people, progressives on the left, lived through hell, and they lived through it to fight another day. It's really important not to say, oh, my, the fascism, they're going to get you. Because if you look south, well, let's see. That may not be the end of history, too. Now, that's a terrible option to think about. But I do think it's very important for progressives to say, okay, if that might happen, let's look south.
Yeah, I mean, history doesn't end, and nothing is inevitable. And
right.
Those are two of the themes that come out of this important book. And we can intervene. We can intercede. We can change things. I was in Santiago 2 years ago. At the Museum of Memory and Human Rights that Bachelet put up. And, you know, there she had been tortured, and her father had been killed, and her mother had been tortured too. And she put up this museum to honor the victims of Pinochet's Chile. And it was incredibly powerful, but it was just to your point. I mean, yes, a lot of leftists like to talk about Pinochet and how he overthrew the democratic government of Allende and how horrible it was, but that country has come back.
Yep.
And it remembers, and there's been some accountability,
right.
And there's democracy, some version of democratic socialism taking root there. So there is hope, and we need to not give in to pessimism, which is another great part of this book, because that's just too easy. It gets all of us off the hook and rewards us for our complacency. We don't want to do that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Gar Alperovitz has been my guest today. He's the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gar Alperovitz, great having you on.
Great. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Terrific book.
Okay. Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.